Blog Talk Radio.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this very important presentation, we begin by the pouring of libation. We pour libation first to our first ancestor, to that hidden one who, though hidden, manifests in all things as all things, that God-goddess idea in the universe by any and all names. To our first ancestor, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they were the first people on this planet, mothers and fathers of all mankind, flashpoint of the human family. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they were the ones who first gave birth to the idea of civilization, knew we would need a form of governance, and they nurtured that idea along the Nile until it reached its zenith in Kemet. There they built these gigantic monuments as evidence of that great civilization, and they carved instructions on the walls of temples and tombs for us so we would never forget. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our ancestors because over time they put together all the tenets of civilization and they took those ideas and left the continent. They were the people of the first Exodus. They left Africa and went all over the world and peopled the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. We pour libation, too, to our ancestors because they did not sit on their laurels. They continued to improve, continued to evolve, and at each point of evolution, they again would leave the continent and settle and resettle the planet. They met themselves coming and going. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to those ancestors because over time, they found themselves the object of a forced exodus. When they were kidnapped, shackled, cargoed, shipped out of Africa and enslaved in diasporas around the world. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to the ancestors left at home, the very young, the aged, the infirm, left to reinvent themselves, depleted of us, human resources. But they were enjoined by us in the diaspora, both objects of a global miasma that ruptured the soul of a people as it ravaged a continent. To those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to those ancestors because over time they began to remember who and what they were. Because no matter where they had been dropped off, they still retained bits and pieces of who and what they were. They retained that African core that describes them. They began to remember bits and pieces of a song. They began to remember lines from a rhythm. They began to remember dances that they did in ancient times. They began to remember those ancient drum beats that they now beat out on bare skin. And so to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to them because they then began to teach each other. They began to resurrect and reconstruct that history and that culture. They became the new Africans wherever they were. They became the new teachers, preachers, archaeologists, the new singers, dancers, the new drummers, the new Jalia. They reconstructed that history and our culture and became new Africans everywhere. So to those ancestors, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to those ancestors because they are the ones who passed that information on to us. And so we pour libation to those of you who will watch this presentation, those of you who are the recipients of that pieced together history, of that reconstructed culture. To you, we pour libation, Ashe. Pour libation, too, to our children and those yet to be born, for they are the ones that you must teach. And you can only teach if you know the history. So to you who are learning the history and are passing on that history, and to our children who are learning that history and will pass that history on to all eternity, but they will call your name in all eternity. To our children we pour libation. Ashe. Ashe. Asheo.
You are listening to Warriors Way Radio, where their motto is continuing the fight. Your host is Brother Kwasi Kraft. Warriors Way Radio is an affiliate of the Sankofa Historical Society, which is a part of the Black Reality Think Tank. And they are operating on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Check them out. Email them at warriorsway101@gmail.com. All of our programs are archived. Just go to www.blogtalkradio.com. Go to the search portal, put in the Sankofa Historical Society, and check out any of our programs that are there. They air every Thursday evening. 6 o'clock. Warriors Way Radio. Continuing the fight.
Hotep family, this is Brother Kwasi Kraft, also known as Shuja Kawatu, which means warrior for the people. Tonight's topic, I'm going to talk a little bit about that Terrell Owens encounter, the racist white neighbor. And the question is, did his fame save him? We've had several incidents where we've had white females call on black males. And the big premise is that, you know, they call the police and they say that they're terrified and they're just outright lying in front of somebody. And I want to ask this question. I personally would be afraid to walk up to somebody with a phone in hand and start lying and saying they did something they didn't do. And generally when you're afraid of someone, you don't yell at them, you don't get in their face, you don't walk towards them or anything like that. And she made these comments, and she happened to be in the company of her husband. And Terrell Owens, you know, the lady claimed that, you know, he almost hit her with this car when he went to check his mail. And she made several other comments indicating he probably can't afford the house that he's staying in, things of that nature. And she knows who he is. She's Terrell Owens, a former NFL great, a Hall of Famer. She knows all of that. But yet, she still called. And she called the police, and the police did show up. And so when you talk about how white people weaponized the police, when the police officer got there, you know, his question wasn't trying to figure out whether this was some bogus call or anything like that. You know, he asked where she got hit. And then she was like, no, I didn't get hit, but he almost hit me. And she was frantically screaming and yelling nonstop. And Terrell Owens, that's during this all this time, he's got his phone out and he's recording everything and he's talking about what's going on. So he's kind of narrating the thing for us as this thing, you know, plays out in front of us. And so he's doing all of that. And it actually happens to be a witness, a lady that was there and that's cleaning out her garage and lives in the neighborhood and said, hey, that didn't happen. She's lying. She's making this up. And the police officer, all he said, you got some ID. And then he started talking to Terrell and saying, hey, you need to calm down. You need to calm down. That whole thing was awkward, you know. And it's something how can you reverse the situation and tell him that he needs to calm down. But, you know, he gave the officer his ID, and, you know, that's what happened from that point on. And I don't think there was anything else that happened behind all of that. You know, she talked to the officer. The officer talked to Terrell Owens. He wasn't arrested. So it played out. But, you know, I'm thinking, you know, maybe his fame saved him. But even still, the officer, the way he handled it, you know, because there was a black lady that witnessed this, and she was just talking. The officer didn't speak with her. He basically spoke with Terrell Owens. But she said, isn't there a law when people make up bogus calls that they can be arrested? So I don't know how far this thing plays out. I didn't follow it anywhere else on some of the other social media sites. But, you know, this is what happens. You know, and this is just so common that we get these phone calls from people that feel that we are a threat. And how do we handle that? And it was his fame, you know. Did that save his life? You know, maybe the police would have been more aggressive, but they couldn't have justify that for a number of different reasons. One, he was videotaping. There was another witness there, but there have been witnesses in situations, and we can use the George Floyd situation. I mean, there were dozens of people on that scene. And this officer is kneeling with his knee on his neck, with his hands in his pocket in front of what he said was a hostile crowd. So can it be if nobody decided to do anything and help out, you know? And so it's just interesting that, you know, they play this stuff out a certain kind of way. But we got to do something about this. You know, and I think that in his situation, you know, his fame might have saved him. But what if it's the average Joe, me or you? And they don't know us like that. And again, she made a reference. She knew that he lived there. Like I said, she made a comment that he was driving too fast and he almost hit her when he pulled up to get his mail and stuff like that. Then she made reference that he probably couldn't afford his place, and that his house was going into foreclosure or something to that effect. And he then made a comment, I got two houses. I'm fine. I don't have nothing to worry about. But the point is, this is what happens. And so just not talking about Terrell Owens, we had, you know, in Ohio, not too long ago, we had a Jalen Walker on a traffic stop. He ran away from the police. They did find a gun in the vehicle, and they ran after him. They caught him, and actually he stopped. And he stopped, and he turned around. He's facing the police. It's eight police officers. They're looking at him. One officer states that he saw Jalen Walker reach towards his waistband and of his front pants, and so he started shooting. Didn't say he saw a weapon or anything like that, but just said that he reached towards his waistband, and that was okay to shoot. And how long it took for him to hit the ground, I didn't hear a discussion about anything like that. But the long and short of it, they shot at least 90 times. Eight officers shot at least 90 times at one person. And in the history of policing among black officers, you're not going to find where some black officers shot down some white person. And especially because they're running from them. There's a difference how this authority plays out, how this authority looks. And this is nothing but clear-cut racism. I bring that up to just talk about so many other things and situations. You had the Dante Wright out of, I'm trying to think of what city that was, if that was, I think that was Minnesota. Yeah, that was in Minnesota. And he was shot after a female officer said that she mistook her handgun for the taser, and she shot and killed him on a traffic stop. And then you have Andre Hill, and I, you know, this right person, he was 20 years old. That was the first person I mentioned. I'm sorry, Jalen Walker. I think he was 25 or 26, and then you have this Andre Hill. He's 47, and he was killed also in Columbus, Ohio. And in his case, he was in the garage, and somebody called saying something suspicious was going on in the area, something to that effect. Long and short of it, he was in his garage. He was working on something in his garage. And when the police arrived there, he had his cell phone in his left hand. And they saw the cell phone, and they started shooting. I believe it was the officer, Adam Coy. And after that, they handcuffed him while he was on the ground. They didn't try to administer any first aid. And we also know that in a lot of these situations, there was a situation in, oh, man, I think this was in Ohio as well, where a young man was shot after he had called 911. The officer that had dropped him off earlier reported back to the scene and told him, I need to see your hands. I need to see your hands. He had his hands up because he was on the phone talking to dispatch. And he was shot, I believe, 9 or 11 times. Long and short of it, he did survive. And he survived because that officer started CPR. And so I guess I want to look at, you know, there's not too many situations where you have white people that are killed in that manner by the police. There was an incident in Mesa Police Department where a man was killed in a hotel by Officer Philip Brailsford. And he was acquitted 2 years, because this happened two years ago. So he retired. He was 28 years old. And you could hear the commands that he was given in regards to telling this young man what to do. And it was very confusing. But the long and short of it, he killed 28-year-old Danielle Shaver, and happened to be a white male. And he was in a hotel, and he was just giving commands that were very confusing. But he indicated to the young man, and it was a young lady that was there, they were laying on the hotel floor, and he indicated that if they make the wrong move, if they don't listen to his commands, it's a good, they can be shot. And that's what he ended up doing. He shot and killed this man, and then he was able to go on disability from the police department, claiming that he has post-traumatic stress disorder, and the police department will pay him $31,000 of his pension until the day he dies. And so you got a guy that's on the department in a short period of time. He's going to be getting $31,000 a year after killing someone unjustly, and then he's claiming post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm not saying that he doesn't have that after killing someone like that and not being able to return to the job. But then you sit here and you think about how many of these officers that kill black and brown people and innocently, and then they end up back out on the streets. And they're not claiming post-traumatic stress. And I just wonder how you can go back out on the streets after something like that happens. You know, I'm wondering about the officers, the eight officers that were involved in that Jaylen Walker that shot and killed him after he had fled from a traffic stop. How did they go home at night? What conversations are they having? Are they married? What kind of person can do something like that and continue to move on and work this job like you did a good job? And one of the things you hear officers talk about and say all the time, I want to go home at the end of the night. That's the most important thing. Well, what about us? And so, this kind of thing, it continues. It's just a tough pill to swallow. And it's like, what do we do? I think that in Terrell Owens' case, that being who he was, he was dealt with differently by the police. They weren't, and one of the officers, when he's talking to the lady that made the complaint, he's like, are you okay? Did he hurt you? Did he do anything? And her statement was, well, he's a big black man, and I'm just a white woman. And again, when you think about these situations and you think about Emmett Till, you know, young teenager, you know, under 16 years old, and some white lady says that he whistled at her, or, you know, something to that effect. And then he gets tortured and beaten, and people rally around, and they his body has just been tortured and beaten. It's unrecognizable. And his mother said, it's going to be an open casket because I want people to see what he's done to my son. And this lady is still alive today. And I just read something about it indicating that they're looking to indict her. The grand jury is looking to indict her. And that's going to be a Carolyn Bryant. Her name is Carolyn Bryant. And so I believe she's in her 80s. And when you think, well, you know, some people say, well, you know, maybe you should let that go. You know, she's old enough, she's older, this, that, or whatever. But then I'm thinking, how old is Bill Cosby? you know, when they went after him. You know, he and his wife, Camille, they have property in California. The government wanted that land. They didn't give that land up. It was said to have minerals and so forth, whether it be oil, other things that the government wants. But the long and short of it, he wouldn't give it up. And then a short time later, his son dies mysteriously. Then after that, he's like, I'm going to buy me the networks and so forth. And then all these charges come up from 40 and 50 years ago. And what kind of charges are they? The charges of, you know, using his power over women, having sex with them, for them getting favors and jobs and so forth. And this was a common thing, you know, that people did, and not justifying saying that that's okay. But you had people brag about that and not be arrested. Woody Allen, you had Charlie Sheen, talks about getting high and waking up with all kind of different women and so forth and this and that. But, I mean, some people can joke about it, but things are different for black and brown people. And so and I heard this, and I can't recall the name, but one of the I can't think of the guy's name, but one of the things they were saying, that one of the things that rappers do is they reveal a lot of things that they did when they were young, coming up and so forth and this and that. And some of these people that are listening to this, that we put all this information out on social media, they research this stuff, try to come up with something, and then try to come after some of these people on these incidents. So we really have to watch out what we do and say on social media. And so things just, I think, it doesn't work out. So I'm going to just kind of get some of your thoughts on these Karen situations. And, you know, we call so many different names. Remember the two young men that were at the Starbucks, and the police were called on them because they weren't buying anything. They were waiting for one of their friends. And the manager said, and one of the guys wanted to use the bathroom. And he said, you can't use the bathroom because you're not buying anything. He said, we're waiting on somebody. He said, he called the police. Long and short of, the police came, they arrested him, put him in handcuffs and so forth. And it's just different for us. And people try to say, you know, stay relaxed. Wait a minute. Why should you even be relaxed under those situations when people are putting you under that type of duress? You know, I can't see how you can relax, but we have to do things different because we're treated so different. And the results can be death or some type of brutality by people that are paid to protect and serve, and we're treated always like the enemy. So your thoughts on some of that? I have a caller on the line, 0148.
Good evening. Good evening, Brother Kwesi. It's a pleasure joining in on the conversation. You know, thank you for picking my call. I often wondered in the little time that I did start off hearing, is maybe there's a standard that we just don't operate by. For example, in going into businesses, if not just so quick to buy anything, but just to see, to feel the surroundings. And if you're uncomfortable with spending your money there, you know, it might be a standard of operation to just tell yourself, I think I better leave, or just let me get out of here. I'm not comfortable within an environment like this. So there are standards, I think, that has to be developed and implemented, right? We understand about police that their jobs is to protect and serve. I understand that. But at the same time, yes, they do go home experiencing this cognitive dissonance of the day. Right? I want to go home to my family.
Right.
But wait, I want to make sure that I'm going to go home and make sure I knock off someone else or cripple or maim or hurt someone else before I go down. you know, maybe there's some other words that's prior to that statement and come afterwards. I just kind of wonder, you know, in the mindset, it's as though do whatever it takes for you to survive and not other people.
Right.
All right. And so surely they have to be thinking of the demise of everyone else, but people who look like them. This is how the operation works out, I think.
You know, that's so true. And I think of that, and I can talk about a lot of these things because being a former police officer, being involved in a lot of tactical raids and situations and stuff where you hear about, you know, you get information about somebody. This person's a drug dealer, involved in some domestic violence, sexual assault, abuse to some women and some children. So you get all this information about this bad guy, you know, and he's selling drugs and he's got a whole bunch of different things. So we get all fired up because we're going to go in there and we're going to get this bad guy. We're going to save these good people that are being victimized by this person. And so it all sounds fine and dandy when you look at it. But one of the things that is real common, I remember we went to a place and we went to the wrong address. And our command officer was not apologetic at all. I mean, we kicked that door down. You know, the city paid for it. But it's like when you make a mistake, and a lot of officers are told, when you make a mistake, don't admit it.
Yep.
You know, then you can walk by somebody like, oh, well, you shouldn't live in this neighborhood. You know, you should be telling on this person and you shouldn't be scared. And if you are scared, oh, tough luck, then you deserve any and everything that happens to you. And so you have a lot of people that have different attitudes when the police show up. You know, they're not always happy. And some people even, and that's even for some of the people that call, they call the police. We get there and show up, and I'm like, look, I didn't want this officer. I wanted that officer because he treats us decent. He treats us with respect and dignity. The rest of you guys see us like we're rats. We're scums of the earth. And, you know, and I get that so much. I have a good friend of mine. He's a homicide detective. He's retired, but he solved over 1,200 homicides in the city of Milwaukee. And one of the problems that he was having was that his partners didn't like working with him, white partners, because they didn't have the success that he had. Why? Because they didn't treat people with dignity and respect, and they would falsely arrest people and do so many other things and stuff like that that would compromise a lot of situations and things that he was doing. So he had to separate himself from those people. Whereas a lot of times, when we know somebody is doing something wrong, the command officer made a bad decision, but he's the command officer, so we got to follow this. And that's something, but then it becomes unlawful. So what do you do? And then you got this, what am I talking about? The immunity that we have, you know, from certain things. So it's very awkward, and, you know, but at the same time, the type of people that we hire, I don't think that we do a lot of good screening. You got people that, I mean, they have a serious problem with people of color. And then when you look at the police department, the whole, I mean, where I was, first black officer, I got hired in 89, and to this day, there's not another one. And there's not a black officer in the other surrounding police departments right next door. And so they have a mentality and a certain attitude. And we have to understand that versus thinking that it's our behavior and it's our conduct, because we've seen white people when they were very aggressive with the police, even hit the police, tried to take their weapons, and the police just kept begging and begging and didn't even shoot them. And let him go. Yeah, matter of fact, the guy had took a state patrol's car and drove off, and they arrested him the next day. You know, without incident.
I got to ask you, is there a black fraternal order of police that entertains these kinds and types of questions at all and talk amongst themselves to be able to see how they're fitting in, how they're being the microaggressions that they experience from both sides of the fence, from the civilian side as well as their brothers in blue. So I'm just kind of curious, is there talk amongst the black fraternal order of police?
There is. There is, and you get alienated so much anytime you have that discussion, because one of the things that goes on with the police department is total denial that there's a problem. And one of the things that they say is that you really don't need to have that. We all need to get along and behave as one. And so with the Milwaukee Police Department, they have the new League of Martin, because the former president, he passed away. And so they call it the new League of Martin. And one of the things that they do is they're supposed to address a lot of the problems that are going on within the police department with a lot of the minority recruits and officers that are on the department.
Okay.
And that, and so you have the organization, but it's more namesake than it is action based. And so a lot of different departments will have that. And basically what it is, and I'll tell you how it works, because I had to use them. Matter of fact, when I was going through the stuff that I was going through, they became a sounding board for me. They connected me with another Milwaukee officer that was going through some harassment from other officers, and he was more or less a sounding board for me so that I wouldn't do something extreme and go after these people, even though they were looking to get me fired, because we've had other people. If you remember that Charles Joyner situation?
Vaguely, but I remember that was the one in California, right?
Right. He was the L.A. officer,
okay.
And the guys that his one of his command officers was from was in that Rodney King incident. He was one of the officers that was acquitted, in that beating of Rodney King, but he was one of his sergeants. And what happened in the Charles Joyner situation, he had made a complaint about an officer that abused somebody in a park, and excessive use of force. And so they then said that, he's making up things. And he was a declared officer, former military person. So he was doing well on the department. But once he made a statement against another officer, a white officer, he was then demonized, and then they had to discredit him. And then they started saying that his job performance was poor and they needed to get rid of him. Long and short of it, they fired him.
I see.
And he responded by killing, I think, a police officer's daughter and a couple other people. And then he was the first person that they used the drone to locate. They found him in a cabin out there in the woods out there somewhere in the L.A. area, I believe it was. And they used some type of military bomb or missile or something to blow up the cabin where he was staying. And so when I was going through what I was going through, I was having some issues about, I didn't care. Here's a job that I love. I took this job to protect and serve. And then I have people lying on me saying that I'm not doing this and I'm not doing that, because I physically stopped people that were, officers that were abusing people on the street. And that's one of the things that I was supposed to do. When I got hired by the chief that hired me, He said he hired me because I had high moral fiber, and he knew that I would be able to handle a lot of the stuff that would be dealing with.
Okay.
You know, I have a strong martial arts background, so I'm okay dealing with multiple people, this, that, or whatever. Whatever the conflict might be on the job. You know, I understand about the firearm shooting aspect of things. I went through all that type of training. But I wasn't the only one that physically stopped other people, other officers, or even other command officers. But I was the only black one. And they had to make an example out of me. And so that's what it was. Because you have officers that stop people. We got command officers and other officers. You don't want to show up. You don't want them showing up on the call. Their prejudice and their attitudes are going to come out, and they're going to recklessly just do something to maybe jeopardize your job and theirs because they want you to keep your mouth shut about something that they did and shouldn't have done. But, you know, and one of the things that they do now, and for people to understand, is that, like, when the body camera is off, I think it flashes. You know, and that's like a signal for that officer to know that, hey, you need to turn your body camera on. So they know when it's off. And a lot of times they turn it off. And then there may be some penalties here and there that they get when they turn their body cameras off or they leave them maybe in the squad car or something to that effect. But even when you have the evidence and it's clear cut and dry, we still suffer. And so at what point is it okay to fight back?
Well, in an environment like that, though, especially when you know you are outnumbered, manpower, physical power, it's kind of hard to fight within a system like that. I don't know. I as you were talking, I'm thinking of what came to mind is like joining a fraternity, right? And you're the novice, so you're the young buck that's coming into the system, mm-hmm. and then you have to pledgee this part that you're playing. You have to do all of these crazy wild things in order to become part of, right? But apparently, mm-hmm. it doesn't quite work like that, right? And so. I don't know. I've never been within an environment like that at all. So you kind of wonder, well, I guess divine intervention is the only thing that will work, I guess. But when will that ever show itself at all? You know, you could try to team up with other people, but you don't have to be moral. Do you have to be? Let me ask that. Do you have to be moral in that kind and type of a career at all? Or just,
I think that you most definitely do. And I think that's one of the things that keeps you from not doing certain things. You know, that you have a certain values and standards that you set about yourself, how you deal. Because here's the deal. 90% of the crimes and everything that goes on are solved by citizens talking to you. These officers aren't doing these great jobs where, you know, they're fine. Somebody tells them something, and then they go follow up on it. There's a lot of times when they don't follow up on something, and then it becomes a cover-up because they don't want people to know that they had this information, but they decided not to check in on it. And we always find that stuff out later. But for the most part, every time something is solved, resolved to this effect, it's because, you know, we get information from citizens, and they always try to make it seem like they're on their own, you know, with this intelligence and so forth. You know, when we're tracking different people and these so-called serial killers that travel and go from place to place, and that's a different story altogether. But again, we still gather information, get intelligence from other people that saw their whereabouts here and there, and, you know, we gather this information. And so it's very important that we have these relationships. But then, you know, the relationships are so jagged and stuff because of how we treat people. And there's this thought process that they always want to throw at you, that you don't know the whole story or the real story.
So if I can ask, through all of this information gathering, it can be subject to everybody's interpretation, whether good, bad, or indifferent. So information gathering is one thing, right? But then who is the head point or point man to interpret and evaluate and come to some kinds and types of decisions after all of that information has been gathered? I'm just kind of curious the nature of the operation. Well, maybe maybe that's not for me to ask. I don't know.
Well, I think it is because, this is why, your decisions is going to be made. That final decision is going to be by the most senior officer if there's not a command officer on the scene. And then even when the command officers make this decision, he gets evaluated by his upper command based on the decision he made. And then if there's some type of litigation and something happens in regards to this where it goes to court, then you get the ruling from the judges. The council or the fire and police commission. So depending on the circumstances of what happened and how things went down, that determines on who all gets involved to what extent. And one of the things that people fail to understand is no matter what happens, when there's a lawsuit paid out, that's taxpayers' dollars. And a lot of people are thinking that, well, the police department, this is why they're losing money because, they can't this and no, they're not losing any money. Matter of fact, a little more when these lawsuits happen, like I said, it comes out of taxpayers' dollars. But they still get, tax you the same for whatever need or whatever increase that they add onto the department that comes out of the taxpayer's salary. And so, that's what you're looking at, and it's sad that despite everything that's going on, everything that we know and see, we still have people that are talking about, we should do things this way. When I have a black son, I have a black daughter, I got to teach them different from my neighbor next door with their kids. I actually have a neighbor next door to me that's a Milwaukee police officer. He has not even looked at me. The neighbors told him who I was. He's a young kid, probably just under 30. I see his parents come by, drop by. Nobody has even waved at me. And I don't go where I believe I'm not watching or anything like that because, again, I got a neighbor to the opposite side of me that have called the police on me numerous times. I'll give you an example. Before my first wife passed away, she had cancer, and I would come check on her. And I worked the power shift. So sometimes I would stop by and it'd be late at night or whatever. But this lady would see my squad car in the driveway, and I worked in Cudahy, and I live in St. Francis. And she would see my squad car in the driveway, and she would call the police department. She would call Cudahy Police Department, and she would say, "I just want you to know, I see your officer. He's over here all the time, and he works in Cudahy, and so I don't think he's supposed to be here in St. Francis." That's what I deal with. And this lady has called the police on me for a number of different things.
So I got to ask, is there such a thing as a domicile law where you are? In other words, the county that that particular person lives and resides in and shops and et cetera, et cetera, in order for you them to be an officer to represent that county, they have to also live there too as well. Is there such a thing as a domicile law, or you can live two counties over, right? And shop, eat, and do all of the pleasurable things there, but you go two counties over and be a police officer there. I don't understand the way the operations work.
Well, you know, they used to have something like that years ago, but they lifted the residency because, you know, as a matter of fact, in a lot of places like in New York, in L.A., and just so many different places in Detroit, Chicago.
Okay.
They wanted to do it here when I was in Cudahy. They wanted me, if an officer decided he wanted to live in the project, because they wanted officers to live as close as they can to the city, so if they ever needed them, you know, then, you know, it's a quick response.
Okay.
But they also wanted officers to have a connection with the people in the community, and they wanted them to live, you know, in some of the areas where, you know, there's a lot of problems.
Okay.
And you could have a program where if you lived in that area, your rent was cheaper.
No. Oh, okay.
And so they had that going, but I decided not to live in some of those areas. But it varies from department to department. But one of the things that they did is they lifted the residency because most people didn't want to work in the city that they patrol in for a number of reasons. One, people get to, you know, if somebody wants to mess with your kid, your family member, you know, they know where you live, this, that, and all this other kind of stuff. But when you live in another city, you know, maybe 10 minutes away or something like that, then you don't have that same worry and that same concern. So I do understand that. And especially when you, if the city that you work in, the area that you work is pretty rough, and you don't really have a lot of good choices. And so that's one of the reasons that, you know, they lifted the residency. Because Milwaukee used to, even when Milwaukee, I'm not sure what their residency is, but I know a lot of people, officers, they would live just outside of the border of Milwaukee, or sometimes they would use somebody else's address as their home address, and they live outside of the area. And that makes a difference on how people and, you know, treat people and stuff, because if you don't live in the area where you're dealing with people, you know, then you really don't, the concern and care just isn't there for somebody that's going to see this person on a daily basis, even when I'm not at work.
Okay.
And that's how it was for me, because I lived in Cudahy for the first several years. So I knew my neighbors. My neighbors knew me. I've had people make threats, family members, and tell me that I see you with your daughter playing and stuff like that. I know what daycare she goes to and stuff like that. And I'm going to, you know, and we've had those things happen.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of different concerns and reasons that, you know, they don't do that. But at the same time, you just have to have that right person, that willing individual that, you know, maybe he's not a family person. Maybe he doesn't have a wife and kids. He's just a young officer that's real ready to try to make a difference and do some things. And, you know, different. I mean, for different people.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. You know, there's a lot of competition, I'm sure, for people who are interested in joining that kind and type of area for a career. And one, namely, are the movies, right, and the images that you see. As you were talking, I was thinking about Training Day. I think that was the movie that Denzel won an award for, right? And he was playing a bad cop. But there are a lot of images that are being portrayed across the silver screen and TV image as well. How much is that influenced young recruits and young officers in the force or academy?
Well, you know what? I think that most people that come up in that situation, they look at it, you know, from TV, you know, you get excited. I remember, and you're right, TV does influence a big
yes,
time.
It does. Yes, it
and,
does.
And I'm going to tell you this because one of my command officers, he wanted to imitate the guy, if you remember The Shield.
Yeah, I remember.
Vaguely,
when that
but came
I remember
on TV?
Yeah.
This is how he wanted to run the department. You knew that guy did whatever he wanted to do to get the job done.
Wow.
And so you had guys pretending that they had to sleep with these women because that was part of the job. And I was just cracking up. I'm like, what do you think? This is Miami Vice? We ain't got it like that. That's not what's going on here. You ain't got to sleep with this drug cartel to get this information. You're just BSing around. But at the same time, it feels it's a power rush when you do certain things and you get the job done and you feel like you're invincible. And that's what we have with some of these command officers. And that's what the TV does to them. It makes them feel like they're invincible because everybody shows them respect. And when they need them, they call them. And you just hope that this guy is going to be a good guy. And then on TV, despite all the rotten things that they may do, they're still heroes. And so you're telling them that, look, you're going to have a bad day. You're going to do some bad things, but that's okay. Because these people out here on the streets are terrible, and they don't deserve your respect or your, you know, and what you give them, you know, they just need to appreciate. And I think a lot of people run with that attitude, and I know our command officer, I mean, when I came to work, you know, the Shield came on, I think, at 8 o'clock. And you'd have about four or five guys in the break room watching the Shield instead of patrolling on the street.
So they were taking off the screen and implementing it in real world. Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean that was so common. And you know, I think about that so much, you know, because I mean. I was liking The Shield too. I sat there and watched it with them sometimes. And here's the thing. But one of the things that I knew that the difference was, and I'm gonna tell you, this is so sad, and this is so common with officers, and especially officers that you get to thinking that you're part of the boys when you sit in there and you watch this. The Shield, and they're showing what they did, and da-da-da-da-da-da, and then somebody orders a pizza for you, or somebody drops off a pizza at the station, and we're all sitting in there, boom, 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 and then all of a sudden we get a call of a domestic or a fight call. So now everybody's all fired up, and we're going to do some of those moves, and we're going to do some of these intimidation tactics in these interviews, interrogations, where we get people in there. I mean, you get fired up.
And I
really do get that because you look at some of these people like, man, they don't deserve it because, you know what they did. You know, I'll give you an example, and it's not like every situation is a real ugly situation, but some people will treat every situation like it's an ugly situation. But you also have to learn how to talk to people in a way that you're going to make them think that you're on that same thinking level. You got to use some different psychology and stuff like that. I had a young man. He was probably just under 30, and he had raped his 4-year-old daughter. And I brought him into the station, and he had a rapport with me. So I interviewed him. And so after I Mirandized him and I started talking to him, I said, wow, your daughter is really mature for her age. I mean, she really looks, wow. I mean, how do you keep the boys off of her? I'm telling him this about his four-year-old daughter. And then he's looking at me like, yeah, she is pretty hot. You know, and so I got him talking to me. And, like, this is making me sick in my head, but at the same time, I got to do this to get the job done, to get this confession out of this person. And I got him talking, long and short of it. I got a confession, and, you know, this guy was convicted. So you do certain things for the job. Now, here's the deal. Some of the things that they portray that they need to do, they don't have to do, and the job and the situation doesn't come to that level of force or level of investigation, but you do those things anyway.
Okay.
Then you create a situation where you come up with some bogus arrest on a person because you don't like the way they looked at you, or you think they might be lying to you, so you try to set them up with tell some other person that this person gave you some information they didn't give so that you can get jumped on. And this is how they treat you for not cooperating with them. I mean, so there's a number of different ways that people get back at you for not cooperating with them. And that was one of the tactics that they did on the Shield a lot of times, where they would threaten a person that they wanted to be a witness to something, and they would threaten okay. them by saying that, I'm going to tell these people you cooperated, you gave me this information. And now who's going to protect you if I tell them that? And so we did things like that,
okay.
you know, and they call that the doing it for the greater good. And I, and so on the department, we did things like that. And I personally couldn't do that because one thing that I wanted to do, because in law enforcement, you know, there's a statute that allows you to lie for the greater good, so to speak. And I just won't do that. So many people are comfortable with doing things unjustly because of the power and recognition that they get for just being a police officer.
Okay.
And so it's a powerful thing. And these TV shows, that you know, they promote that a lot. The Chicago PD.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
the guy. Yeah. I just saw that guy. I don't know what his name is, but I saw he was trying to get some information because some lady had his officers in a locked up in a room, and there was a door that they couldn't blast or get beyond, and she had the combination. Long and short of it, he ended up stabbing her in the hand. He had her, you know, and she ended up confessing, giving him the combination, and got in there and stuff. But you see stuff like that, and for some people, they think that, well, that's what you got to do sometimes to get the answers that you need.
Wow.
And, but they forget that this is TV. And so we've had those things happen, and some of us have told about these incidents that happened. There was, I think you probably saw it on social media. There was a female officer that stopped one of her command officers from roughing up somebody on the street, and then he grabbed her by the throat and pushed her up against the squad car. And he had his hand up like he was going to hit her. I mean, he was that angry at another officer for stopping. And here's the thing that we're supposed to do. And this is a statute. This is a statute. It says that if we knowingly see an officer abuse his authority and take advantage of somebody and unlawfully injure, hurt, harm somebody or lie, and we do nothing about it, then we're party to the crime. So we have to do something about it. That's what we're supposed to do. But now you got this implied immunity where people don't do anything. Then all the other officers just say, I didn't see anything. You know, so, I mean, we just have such a ugly situation. And, you know, like I said, when I was, you know, we started talking about this Terrell Owens, and, you know, how many people that aren't Terrell Owens that get called by the police and then they're dead or beat up or arrested? You know, so you got all these things that are just constantly going on, and we're trying to figure out how we can navigate through all this, and it's tough.
Okay.
It's tough. But yeah, that's say it again.
I was getting ready to ask, and I don't know how familiar you are with detective level and maybe undercover level, but is it like that? I mean, we're talking about the police force, I guess the ground level, but does it escalate more so as you start going up into situation like in detective level or undercover level or?
Most definitely. Because basically what happens is we support them. You know, we do a lot of background work and investigative work for them. A lot of times, you know, they're working, you know, a lot. We may turn over. We may have the initial investigation. I investigate a sexual assault, and then it leads to some other issues and so forth. So now a detective takes it over because this is a long, drawn-out kind of situation, and maybe, or especially if it's a homicide. So if it's a homicide, okay. It's a rape, you know, you have the initial officer that arrives on the scene, and then it gets turned over to a detective.
Okay.
And then most of these detectives, you know, I mean, they had to be police officers for a couple of years, at least. Some departments, you got to be on there for at least 3 years before you take the test to become a detective. And then you have some people, it's a shorter period of time. And then we had one department, I know, where they let officers rotate in, and they call them investigators, not detectives, but they call them investigators. So, and I think South Milwaukee kind of does that. And so you may work 2 years as an investigator, then go back to patrol. And so what you do is you go to school and you get a lot of this interrogation and investigation training.
Okay.
And they found out, and that's with that Reed training, if you ever heard about that. And because we all took the Reed training interrogation and investigation school, and they found that none of that works. But that's what we use in regards to saying whether or not a person was innocent. So if I'm talking to you and having a conversation, and I ask you something, and you turn your head, well, that's a sign right away that you're telling a lie. Or if I'm talking to you and you change the subject or you stutter, that's a sign. And so all these little things that they use to try to determine that whether or not the person was, they found all that stuff to be a lie and not true, and not to be a valid test of whether or not somebody's telling the truth or whether somebody's lying. That is not a valid test. Well, you know how many people have been arrested using that system? Millions. And most of them that look like us.
Okay.
And that's been proven. And so when you say detectives, you know, at that higher level and so forth, they know better, but they don't do better because it becomes a power thing. I have this thing where I can get rid of you for 30 years, 25 years. You better do something for me. And you have that. You have a lot of people that have these relationships with people in law enforcement based on favors that they've done for them. And one of the things that we do, and we try not to accept gratuities. And that's one thing that I wouldn't do. When I used to stop at the service station when I was working third shift, and they were like, oh, you know, coffee is for free for you guys. And I would never take her. I said, no, I don't. You know, and then if I buy a soda or something, and they're like, well, your money's no good here. I said, well, then I can't come here anymore. So then they would take my money. But one of the things that would happen is,
I'm sorry.
But one of the things that would happen was, this one guy, and this was in our court in Cuddy, he was a business owner, and he said he got a speeding ticket from one of the officers. And he said, it's just no way I should be getting a speeding ticket, Judge. Your officers come to my business all the time. They come get lunches. They come get this. They come get coffee, all kinds of – they don't pay for nothing. And then I said, I have an itemized list. And then he showed a list of over $1,000 worth of food that he's been dishing out to the officers for the last couple months for free. And it made it, so they got on our case telling us, you guys can't do this anymore. But the guy got off his ticket. But, you can't make guys, you can try. But back then we didn't have the video, like cameras and stuff and all that. Otherwise, man, that'd been crazy. Because even now, the officers know that they got cameras on. They still forget that cameras are on and they do certain things. And then even when they know that the cameras are on, they know that people will look at, you have different command officers or officers. Their job is to review the cameras. And then if they see something that's suspicious or whatever, then they take it to somebody else and then they determine how they're going to handle it. But your problem becomes is that information might not be just on your camera. It might be connected to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So they might also be able to have access to that. So if you try to cover it up, it's going to blow up later on at some point. And so this is why we get a lot of these different cases. They come out a year later to several months later, and that's after these long reviews of these cameras. So just think of when we didn't have cameras and all the corruption, because the corruption has always been there.
Okay.
And that's not going away. But at the same time, they make it seem like we are the most villainous people on the planet, but we're not the most killingest people, when it comes to us in these jobs and being in these positions of authority. But they do use us when they need to use us to justify some white officer killing some black person. They always bring some black person in, whether it be a chief, an attorney, or somebody, to justify the actions of this person.
I see. A system within a system, huh?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. It's a tough situation, but, like I said, that's what we deal with. And, like I said, somebody like Terrell Owens, he was lucky being the status person that he is. But even still, the officer still had a negative attitude. And sometimes those negative attitudes are this: I don't care how much money you got, you still are in. And so they treat you at a certain – you can sit and you can say, we need to get these black organizations. Well, these black organizations don't have power like that when you're dealing with white people under their terms and under their system. We have to understand that the system doesn't work for us, and it was never designed to work for us, but yet we keep trying to articulate things a certain kind of way, do things a certain kind of way, or blame each other. I mean, you've heard this, and you've asked this question, are we our worst enemies? And I'm like, there's no way that we can be. But it's part of the conditioning to make us think that we are. Therefore, we won't look at them. I had somebody, I was talking to them earlier, and they were talking about all the people that are killing each other and all this and that. And I'm like, why? Why? When you talk about people that don't know who they are, and you put them in this and that, this is what happens. and who controls the information that they're receiving. You know, so we continue to operate on a, under an oppressed situation, and then we want things to be better. You know, you were on the show last night, and I just listened to it, about slavery and the effects of it and the trauma of it, and listening to the show and about how women were being abused, and even by these so-called people that were preachers, you know, to promote Christianity, and they would rape them before church to get them to go to church, and then put them on the table, and multiple guys would rape them, and then they'd go to church and then tell them to pray for forgiveness.
Right.
I mean, all these different things, but all these different things that have shaped us in the manner in which how we do things and how we look at things. And how do you put fault on people that have gone through this trauma and still experiencing this? And then you sit here and you can think, okay, look at the, well, the Jews, they aren't going through this like that. The Arabs aren't going through this. Indians and all these Japanese, why? Why not? Because they get reparations and they have been adopted as being the better species. What happened when they had the when the Taliban was killing all these Arabs and so forth? They brought them to the United States and they got over $1 billion for reparations and so forth. Money for so that they can have their schools, businesses, jobs, churches, all of it. They set all of that stuff up for them.
Mm. Mm.
You know, but at the same time, they're still trying to figure out how they're going to give us reparations. You know, so that should tell you something about how they feel about us. And so I always talk about this. Somebody had made a mention to me about, they talked about Michael Jackson, they talked about Prince, and they talked about, those are two entertainers that they did all these different things, but they were on these drugs and they didn't take care of their health. No, that wasn't it. Both of those brothers were geniuses, and they made means of buying the record companies to produce their own music and take money out of Sony and all these other music giants. And they couldn't have that. And so anytime we talk about people that have done so many different things, or you think about, you know, Bill Cosby and everything that he did and all the money and this and that, wait a minute, you're getting too powerful. We got to take you down. You know, so these charges come up from 40 or 50 years later. His son gets killed. You know, now he wants to buy it, you know, so. But what the lady that, you know, like they're talking about indicting her now, you know, that claimed that Emmett Till looked at her a certain kind of way and, you know, and then they beat and they murdered this kid. And where's the uproar from people that don't look like us? They say, yeah, she should be in prison. But we will jump on that bandwagon on their behalf.
Okay, okay.
It's not a two-way street. You know, it's pretty ugly. But like I said, we just have to do more about us and learn so much more. Like I listened to what was being said about some of these books, and I have to get these books because it just gives me a different understanding about, you know, the rape of black women during slavery, and then one of the things that Doc Rogers talked about when he talked about also some of the white women that wrote books about how the mistress or the wife of the master felt with her husband having these mistresses and how she treated the slaves and what she did in retaliation. I mean, so it's just so much and so much of the trauma that we talk about, you know, is, I mean, you mentioned it in conversation. You talked about, you know, this trauma that we're dealing with. It's continuous because we get no reprieve from this.
There's a system, I'm sure, that we will have to work towards healing more so than anything else. How do we heal from these different kinds and types of traumas that are variable, that can hit at rapid pace and rate? So how do we heal from this? And is a question that I kind of ponder from time to time. I don't know. It's just interesting.
Well, you know what? I think I think healing is easier than people think.
You said easier?
And I'm just going to give you a real easier.
Okay.
I am the problem for you. Every day you go to school, I beat you up. I take your lunch money. I bully your sister. You know, I take your shoes. I do all these different things. And I just keep doing all these things to you. And then one day, you know, you decide you're going to do something. And you prepare yourself in a way that you know that you're going to be successful. Whether you train yourself, you learn some different things. And now all of a sudden, here I come. I'm going to take this from you. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. But now you're able to stop me. You're no longer being bullied or threatened, or they're able to take these things away from you. Now you feel empowered. Now you ain't worried about this getting hit again, because the doctor said if you get hit again here in this eye, you're going to lose this eye. But you prepared yourself because you didn't want to lose that eye. You didn't want to go without this and without that. You prepared yourself some kind of way. And so what happens, and I think, is this. People have convinced us not to fight back. And so even when you talk about the numbers don't work out for us, it's not a numbers game. First of all, you know, if one thing bad happens to any one of them, they can't handle that. But the bottom line comes down to this. If we start doing more and putting up resistance here and there, they're going to change what they do and where they do it. And those things have happened many a times, whereas, you know, back in the 70s, and Milwaukee, and a lot of people would get beat up on the street. And then all of a sudden it was like, you know what? There was too many people that was witnessing this and rallies and all kinds of stuff and people that would even fight with the police. So guess what? They started doing what they were doing in the stations, in the booking rooms versus out on the streets. That was some decision that some of the command officers made. I know that from talking to some of the officers. And they made those decisions based on what was happening out on the street, how the people were rebelling against law enforcement. And that was going on kind of all over the country. They were telling people not to do certain things, telling officers to handle things this way. You know, sometimes you know, and they would say, hey, look, if you think this is going to happen, you know, taking this guy in at this party, at this club, you know, unless it's a homicide, this, that, or whatever, we ain't doing it. We're not going to go in this place, and then all of it's a couple hundred people, because even though, you know, systematically, we're not outnumbered, but in regards to weaponry, in regards to how the organized attacks are, well, that's a different story. They're more organized in what they do, and they have support from so many different levels of the government, you know, where we're talking about the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, Marines, all of that, the National Guard, and so forth. And so, I mean, so we do need to organize. We do need to prepare ourselves. And there's many of people that have taken a stand. And like I said, and sometimes it's fighting back. As a matter of fact, you hear about white people fighting back all the time, and it's their constitutional rights. And that's okay. But it's not okay when we do it. And so, and I remember in closing, Doc Rogers had made a comment about how is it that this white kid can walk into this church, and was that in North Carolina? That Dylann Roof?
Yes.
You know, a young white kid that, and it didn't raise any suspicion with anybody. Here's a guy that doesn't attend this church, and he comes in there and he sits in there, and nobody questioned him. This, I can guarantee you, and you walk into a church here in this city, predominantly white people, somebody's going to confront you some kind of way, find out why you're here, talk to you, kind of look you over, make sure you ain't got nothing. And you're probably going to be okay with that, understanding the climate. But at the same time, and this is the way I look at it, and this is my thoughts behind this, is that we are so wanting to prove our acceptance, wanting to prove that we're not racist people, that we don't hate, I mean, we can't be racist, but the problem is that we don't hate you guys. That we will let you come in our backyard and play. I know I can't go in your backyard and play, but I'm going to show you that I'm better than you. I'm going to take the high road. I ain't going to take the low road. You know, Michelle Obama was saying that all day long. And I'm like, when you go low, I will go lower. I'm not going to allow you to do this and that to me.
All right, let me interject, if I may, because somehow or another we lost the spirit of discernment. We referring to black people, melanated people, African Americans, Negroes, however you want to classify, we've lost the spirit of discernment. Just like with sisters, it's as though you kind of ask, who amongst you has mother wit? All right? There's some things, some very basic fundamental things that we no longer have. And so how do we get that back? How do we reclaim ourselves in such a way as to acquire that spirit of discernment once again? When we have that sense of really peering through visually, and almost having that feeling as though this is uncomfortable, right?
Mm.
How did we lose that? Why did we lose that? Can it be taken back? There are a lot of basic fundamental questions that need to be asked and answered. But, you know, I think about the Dylann Roof that you brought up, the church shooting there. And they were elderly people. They had some, I guess, 35 to 40. I don't know all of the demographics of the ages and et cetera. But we have been trained so much and for so long to be trusting of others.
Yeah.
And not be able to ask questions at all. How do we get that back? How do we be able to be able to ask them, who are you? What are you doing here? How can I be of service to you? To be able to step forward before they act, or whomever it is, right? We've lost that. Can we obtain that back?
You know what? I think that we can, because here's the thing, and this is one of the reasons why we don't have a lot of that, because they have changed the image in how we look at black men. You know, it was okay to always show that you're a strong, powerful athlete and everything like that, but when it came down to anything else, when it came down to dealing with certain challenges and social issues and this and that, you know, you had to let the women speak for you because you couldn't speak for yourself. And then when they did allow you to speak, that's only because you spoke out of a different mind frame. And when I say that, you know, and I'm talking about a lot of the gender identification issues. You got so many people that they don't know who they are. And then they're following these different organizations that say, you know, it's okay to be this way and that way, and you got Bruce Jenner's first year coming out, you know, call himself Caitlyn, and they become Woman of the Year, you know, and how did that happen? But it's a movement that's going on, that's telling, you know, and we've been dealing with this like forever, where they're always telling men, you know, and kids, that men, you're too masculine. You need to get in touch with your feminine side. You don't have, I'm a man, I don't have a feminine side. There's a movement that they're always telling you to be more feminine. And so you're seeing so much of that. So when you talk about people fighting, and doing things, you know, they're trying to erase that type of mindset and thought out of your head. You know, why should I be a fighter? I'm a lover. You know, I love my people, and we got other ways that we can do it. They got all these different movements that have structured how we should deal with people, how we should look at people. And fighting is the last thing that you do because it doesn't accomplish anything. So you got all this stuff where they talk about bullying, and how do they talk about dealing with bullies? You know, you deal with bullies by, because I was with the Generations Against Bullying, and I was with them for a while, and I didn't like a lot of the stuff that they did. And so, but one of the things that they talk about is that, you know, you have an upstander. If somebody's bullying you and so forth, you know, if somebody intervenes and stuff, usually that bullying goes away inside of 5 minutes. But what if that it consists and it gets consistent? What do you do? And so we've always used the police to demonize people of color. And now we say that anytime you need to get something done, we don't want it to be you, just call the police. You know, it's just like when we were young kids, if something bad happened, our parents came up to the school, we did these different things, and sometimes we get into these fights and so forth. But now they have changed the way things are being done. You get into a fight, the police are being called on these little kids, and then they're getting arrested, and they're getting criminal records, and then they're being demonized early and traumatized at a very early age by the police. And then you're wondering why. And so now you got them mapped out for the criminal justice system. And now your parents, the mothers and people are like, hey, you know, don't fight. Do this. You know, and they're telling you all these people and all these systems that they got in place that's supposed to help you and stop you from getting beat up. But it keeps happening. And so we just need more police. And as long as they keep thinking that you need more police and you can't do anything for yourself, you can't defend yourself, you can't learn how to do this and learn how to do that. There was a something on TV last night. I happen to know the guy. He asked him to be a former police officer. And there's a city in Cudahy, and they were talking about a family that everybody is a black belt, from the little kid to the adult. And then the parents got an honorary black belt from the kids, but it's like seven of them. But they learned how to protect themselves, and they talked about that being a good thing. And see, and the thing about it is, as black people, we've been always villainized as being very mean and aggressive people. And so you had, what's this guy's name, Terry Crews. A prime example. White producer, real famous, walks up to him, grabs him by the genitals, looked at him, makes all these facial gestures like he's having oral sex with him, and then he grabs him. He explains this. Then he's like, hey, what are you doing? And he's with his wife. Terry Crews is with his wife. He's a big guy. He can handle himself. Used to be pro football, did a number of different things, and he's very fit, always tearing his shirt off, doing this and doing that. Not only does the guy do it once, he does it twice. He walks up to him, he grabs him again. Then on the second time, he pushes him. D.L. Hughley makes a comment about it and says, God didn't give you all those muscles not to do something to somebody if they did that. And then Terry Crews is more or less bragging about he did the right thing. He's doing the Me Too movement thing, and he's going to be suing this guy. And so, but at the same time, he's mad at D.L. Hughley for saying what he said, and he could punch this guy or hurt him some kind of way. You want to see me do something? Okay, how about me and you? You know, I mean, so why are you mad at D.L. Hughley, a comedian, for making a joke? Like Chris Rock made a joke about Jada Pinkett, but that's not the one that grabbed you. So here's a white guy that grabbed you like that. And so what example are you showing other black people how they need to defend themselves when they look up to this? I mean, are you going to respond that way? I mean, I can see if you're old and you're not able and capable here, there, and this and that, so you're asking for help from somebody. But we're letting other people tell us what our defense looks like. And you can't do that. But this is what we do. You know, and there's a number of reasons why I understand that people do that, because one, I want you to come home at the end of the night, because as a black person and you defend yourself and the police show up, you can get killed. I understand that and I get that. But at some point, we still have to protect ourselves and protect our family. And they have reframed how we look at that and how we do that. This is why this Dylan Roof gets to go into this church and does it. This is why this other kid gets to go to Buffalo, New York, sits outside, talks with one of the people before he starts shooting in a parking lot, then goes in the store and kills 10 more people. Then the police take him in, okay. Don't shoot him. Don't do anything. Make sure the guy talked about killing himself, and, you know, but that's as far as that went. Now, if he really wanted a confrontation, he could have went a number of different places in New York. But he wasn't going to go there and be confronted by some black people that were willing to fight, because we got plenty of black people that are willing to fight, but we don't show them other than when we talk about people that are were involved in a shooting where a group of people shot and killed each other. Outside of that, we're showing black people, showing us how to fear other black people. But we're not showing people like myself that teaches people how to protect themselves and what they need to do. I work with people on a daily basis on these type of things. So this is something that, as a matter of fact, I'm doing something this weekend with a group of women, you know, on personal safety. And I tell you something. I went to a gun store run by these white guys out here in the Milwaukee area. And this guy, he's talking to me. He knowing that I'm a former police officer, they don't care that you're black. They know that you've been trained, and you're going to be their puppet. And I was telling them about a situation where, you know, I got into a use of force situation where I had to use deadly force. And I was telling them about the situation where the somebody believed the guy had a dog brush and that I shot a guy with a dog brush. And he justified that. He said, well, it doesn't make a difference. If you believe that he was threatening you in any way, shape, or form, you know, it's okay whether he had a dog brush or a pencil or whatever. And I understand what he's saying, but you're looking at probably a guy that's not very capable in a whole bunch of different things, but he can pull that trigger. And he knows that the system works for them, and so they're real entitled in giving that out, that advice like that. Somebody like me that understands that, and we've had the Edgecombe guy that shot that lawyer not too long ago, and he claimed self-defense. That didn't work for him. But then you got the Kyle Rittenhouse that shot some people, and actually one of the persons had a gun that could have shot back, and he wasn't doing that. His intent was to try to help people, and Rittenhouse was out there trying to say that, you know, he was out here protecting property. Well, you can't use deadly force to protect property, but he had his, you know, and then it's just so much stuff. But the point is, we're not looking at or seeing a lot of strong examples of people that look like us that are handling situations where people are aggressively attacking us and doing certain things. And we put them in check. You know, they will show, and they highlighted the Chris Rock, Will Smith thing over and over again, black-on-black violence. That's how they put it out there. And they'll show that all day long and forever.
You know, I got to ask. Let me ask you, with the time that we have remaining, how strong is fear in counteracting an assault or some sort of attack of sorts? How does fear play a part, number one? And number two, you mentioned about a training that you're going to do with women. Will you introduce verbal judo at all in that exercise? So two things. One, how does fear play a part in all of what this that you've talked about for almost the past 2 hours now? And will verbal judo be instituted in your training, as part of your training?
Well, I like what you said about verbal judo from George Thompson. That's the guy that designed that program several years ago, and he's long passed away since. And as a matter of fact, law enforcement kind of got away from using verbal judo because he passed away and they didn't want to pay, you know, his family still by using that system. So they came up with another system. But that was a very, very good system in how you would paraphrase, reach things to get people to talk, to listen, to think, and always try to de-escalate situations and stuff. But at the same time, while you're de-escalating situations, you were putting yourself in a better position of advantage to take care of something or buying yourself time. And so that was a very good system. But what you were saying about fear is can be a motivator. And fear can also be a major, major breakdown. Because sometimes, you know, like as a fighter, I have this fear all the time. But my fear prepares me. You know, I use my fear as a positive. You know, I know the pluses and the minuses. So I'm very calculated in what I do, and I know I'm very capable because I train and I prepare, you know. But also the fear part of it is that it's the unexpected. you know that somebody's going to attack you some kind of way. They're coming at you. There's imminent. It's imminent danger. And this is how we relate that and talk to people about these different things. But some people let fear control them. And so when they control them, they may back up a certain way. They may close their eyes. They may freeze when they should be moving some kind of way. And so fear can be negative when you don't control your emotion, because it's just an emotion, you know. But when you let that emotion control you, you know, like one of the things that somebody was talking to me the other day, just in conversation, they said, man, for you to hurt this guy, you really had to get mad. I said, I never get mad. Because anger is that emotion that, you know, distracts you. You know, it can blind you from seeing things. So I let nothing get in the way of the weapon. And so fear is something that you understand. You use it. And when I say I use it by preparing myself to deal with the situation. And see, one of the things that we learn when we do the martial arts things, we say a warrior goes into battle already dead. So he knows no fear. So this is where I am with that. I'm already, you know, Malcolm X basically said the same thing. Why? I'm already dead, so I'm not worried about them killing me. I am not worried about them killing me. And so, but, and when we talk about, and one of the things that I get irritated when you hear officers say this thing, I feared for my life. When fear sets in and you see people tremble, you see people, their judgment, everything just gets impaired a certain kind of way. And that's for certain people. It doesn't respond. It doesn't do that for everybody. But see, I don't have that fear where it happens that way. And when I say that, I mean that I'm not scared. Understand that when I get in a car and I drive, you know, I could get hit. I know that that's something that can be happen. And I, you know, I try to do everything that I can, but it can happen. And sometimes I'm not going to see it. But that's what happens when you take it, when you go out on the road. Those things can happen. And so, but if you continue to worry about it, it makes you do things different, and you will miss some things. And I don't want to miss out on doing the things that I need to do to help me get better at this and that. And this is how I teach people as far as preparing for that moment. And we call that moment of truth. When you prepare yourself to do this and to do that, then it's time to go. Because other than that, it's just theory. I can say to you, when was the last time you did this and did that, or have you ever knocked somebody out? Have you ever choked somebody out? Have you ever done anything? Have you ever somebody from coming at you and you had to do this and you had to do that, and some things that you worked or practice, it worked for you? And a lot of people can't say that because they don't practice. And that's what happens with a lot of your law enforcement people, whereas they don't train the way they need to train for combat in a lot of situations. And not to make that an excuse as to how why they treat black people that way, because even though they don't train a certain kind of way, they still don't treat white people that way. They don't like black people, and this is why it's okay. I can't go around – I cannot like white people in this net, but I'm still not going to be killing them like that and then go to sleep or have a sandwich and kiss my kids goodnight. I will be emotionally just messed up some kind of way, you know, because I just don't have that kind of hatred for people like that. I just don't have room for that. But – I see that, and I recognize that to be so common with them. And I can say that because people and you hear about these killings and stuff like that. And when I heard the guy was talking about the Jaylen Walker that they killed in Ohio that ran away in that traffic stop. And I've had everybody, white person that I talked to, say, well, why'd he run? Why'd he run? They could care less about this guy being shot at 90 times and hit 40-something times. And where did all those other bullets go in the black community? They're not talking about that. I mean, so there's a lot. And so when officers, and I thought that at some point when people say they fear for their lives, that's going to come back and bite them. Because what happens when people get scared? They jump. They do all kinds of different things and stuff, you know, and they make different mistakes and stuff like that. I mean, they have all kinds of different reactions. You know, they over or under do something. And so I don't like the fear. When I was involved in a deadly force situation, and they said, well, did you fear for your life? I didn't fear for my life. I saw a threat, and I stopped it. That was it. The fear, I'm used to people coming at me because this is how I train. These are the things that I've been in. So a lot of this stuff from people coming at me, it's not theory because I've done it. I've taken big people out, multiple people. I've been involved in these situations. And so for the average person, and I'm not bragging or boasting or anything, I'm just talking about the experiences that I've had that I can attest to, and the average person can't say that. And even a lot of officers can't say that. But a lot of people assume that they have that training, and they don't. But one of the other things that they don't have, they don't have compassion for every person. And the ones that do aren't the ones that are working that job. Because I just couldn't shoot somebody just 49 times. Two people that are already dead 49 times. That's another incident in Ohio that they did. That's the Netflix movie's 140 shots. And the officer said, I feared for my life. So he jumped on top of the car where these people were in and stood on the hood and shot 49 times. So is that really fear? He's just showing his dominance. And he understands what he can get away with, but he also understands what verbalization of saying what he said. And those were 13 officers involved in that. And not one of them was arrested. Charges brought up against them for that incident. And these were two innocent people that were killed because they claimed that the car backfired. So I hope answers somewhat of your question in regards to the fear and the verbal judo and stuff.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so very much for entertaining my question.
Yeah, I'm surprised. Where did you hear about the verbal judo? Did you have a class?
No, I never had a class. I just kind of came across, you know, different kinds and types of articles. And you know, I wonder, I ask kind of basically the same questions that you asked with regards to how does one fight back? What is it that we need to know? What is it that we need to train? You know, sometimes to the common person, you know, when they say fight, F-I-G-H-T, back, you know, I get, well, in my mind, you know, you fist the cuff and you know that blood is rushing and, you know, you're protecting, you're swinging back, et cetera. And sometimes, you know, it's not really called for, right? So what are other ways in which one can learn to fight back? What do I have to equip myself with? And the Queen's English is one of those things that popped up in my head. And so how are you able to do Isaiah 1, chapter 8, chapter 1, verse 18, come and reason together, right? How is that actually done when we start talking about fighting and combat and engaging with other people who are different than us? I think that there are people who know that there's 3 feet of airspace that circumscribes all of us. And so when that space or that sphere of existence is penetrated, adrenaline starts to flow, right? and you have that fight versus flight kind of situation. And so what is it that we need to know in order for us to protect ourselves? Sure, we could say sir and ma'am and try to calm the situation that way, but maybe that's not too effective, right? What are other things that we need to know or do?
Well, here's the thing. Just look at this. If The Rock was standing there at delivering the speech at the Oscars, Will Smith wouldn't have walked up there and hit him. And so people do what they do based on what they think they can get away with.
I see.
And so if I see that this is a fight that I'm not going to win, I'm not going to engage in it. I'm going to have a discussion. You know, and so there's a lot of different things that determine why we do what we do. But I'm going to have to close this program. We only got about 2 minutes left. So I want to thank you, Brother Lux, for joining me tonight on this show.
And
we'll be back next Thursday with another show for you guys at 6 p.m. This is Warrior's Way, continuing the fight. Thanks again for being here. And thank you a lot, Brother Russ, for joining us.
Ashe. Thank you.
Okay. All right, Pete.
For African people, nothing important happens without a libation. And so for this...
I know you're asking today, how long will it take? Somebody's asking, how long will prejudice blind the visions of men? I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment,
yes, sir,
however frustrating the hour, it will not be long,
no,
because truth crushed to earth will rise again.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
Yes, sir.
Because no lie can live forever.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
How long?
Yes, because you shall reap what you sow.
Yes, sir.
How long?
How
not long.
Long. How long?
Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne.
Yes,
that scaffold sways the future.
Yes,
behind
sir.
The dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. How long? Not long.
Long.
Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Yes,
how long?
Not
long.
Not long.
Because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Yes,
he's trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
He's loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword.
Yes,
his truth is marching on.
Yes, sir.
He has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat.
Peace,
he is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat.
Yes,
oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on.
Yes.
Glory, hallelujah.
Yes,
glory, hallelujah.
Hey, Grandpa, the sink, the handle on the sink just popped off and the water is running. How can we turn it off?
What say again?
In the kitchen, the handle sink.
The handle?
Popped off, yes. And the water is running and we need a way out to turn it off.
Did you look under the sink? There should be a knob up under there.
We tried the knob. We twisted it in.
It went out? It wouldn't do what?
It didn't work. It didn't turn the water off.
Okay. Let me give you this, the guy's number. And he can maybe tell you where to cut it off. And then you can, he can come up there and fix it in a few minutes. Hold on a second.
Oh, he lives here?
Huh?
He lives here in the building?
No, no. How did it break right there? Did they ever come to look at the house?
No, not again. Not ever since we talked. Okay. Okay.
You got it?
Yeah, but it's still leaking though.
Okay, hold on a second. Okay, I got it.
Yes.
Hey, Sheila, how you doing, buddy?
All right,
yourself? Good, good. My granddaughter just called me. She said that the sink in the kitchen something on the handle popped off and water just gushing off. Said she was trying to get under the sink to turn the knob, but when she got under there, it doesn't cut the water out. The water just keeps coming. Is there another way to cut that water off?
Wait a minute, say that again. Something, water's dripping out and she needs to cut the water off?
Yeah, because it's the handle broke. The handle
broke in your unit?
And then the water's gushing out where the handle is.
Unit?
I don't know what it is, just the water is coming out of the handle. And she was trying to cut it off from the bottom up. I told her to go up under the sink. She said they tried that, but it didn't.
Oh, oh.
Yeah, are you in the phone?
Yeah. Okay, go ahead. Yes, hello?
Hello?
Yes. Is this in your unit?
Is this what now?
Is it in your house, your unit?
I couldn't hear that last part you said. Shia, is that you?
Yes, I said, is this in your unit?
Yeah, that's in my unit. It's in my unit. She said there was a knob, but she tried to turn it and didn't cut it off.
Okay,
all right. Okay. Hey, Yana.
Yana. Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's on the way over there.
Okay, good. Okay, thank you. Is he going to call you?
Say again?
Is he going to call you?
No, he's coming over to the house.
Okay.
Yeah, just let him in. Just let him in.
All right, thank you.
Okay, all right.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.